The person who is in charge of our team here got an accident this morning. That's why there wasn't any system concept. And secondly, there are apologies. The second one is not an apology, but it's indirectly to me an apology. Honorable Madrofa is not here. She lost her husband last week. And that's why she's not here. And there's Honorable Gayla, who's not here. Honorable Minister, we have got a doctor's appointment. And are there any apologies? In the absence of any apologies, we have got a new member that is representing COPE. She is Honorable Matiwane. Honorable Matiwane, can you please raise your hand so that they all see you? You are welcome to this committee. COPE wasn't with a member for quite long. I'm sure for a year. And we welcome you to this committee. Deputy Minister, welcome. CD. Today, the Department of Public Works is going to present a report on the status of construction, the property charter, and all other outstanding policies and legislation to us. Without any waste of time, and the DG will leave us for an appointment as chairperson of select committee in the NCOP. Let me allow him to open this meeting before leaving. Thank you. Over to DG.
Let me first send an apology to Mrs. Padella in the PDG construction property. She was going to wait us. She was going to be with us except for urgent matters that relate to health in the MS. She couldn't be with us. I have brought my colleagues in the branch, some the two of whom you are familiar with, who will be doing the presentation, Mr. Devon Pillay and Andre Mary from the branch under Ms. Pankin. Chair, as you have stated, we will be dealing with the matters that as the committee's request, the presentation has been issued, which will be structured so as to cover to the extent possible all the issues that have been raised. The first part, this will be under Section A under legislation. Mr. Pillay will be dealing with the agreement, and then the built environment protection proposed policy, and then the establishment of IBT as a public entity. And then Ms. Mering will deal with review of the Expropriation Act, and then they will exchange their conclusions with regard to the status of the outstanding policies. That is the basis on which the presentation will be done. I will then be available later to take questions on issues that the members of the committee will have raised together. Thank you. Mr. Pillay.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, DM, good morning. I will start off, we will start with AgriMark SA under the legislative program, which includes the expropriation which Mr. Mary will undertake, and then I will come back and do the presentations on the built environment proposed policy and the establishment of IT as a public entity. Secretly we'll deal with the construction sector charter council and the public sector charter councils, and then we'll go to the two outstanding policies on immovable asset condition assessment guidelines and the prestige model standards done by Mr. Mary. Chairperson, on AgriMark South Africa presentation, many members may recall we've done a very similar presentation some time ago as we're developing and moving towards the possible. Many of the issues may sound repetitive, but we've kept them in the presentation just for a refresher on subject. Just to go through it, is AgriMark was established in 1969 through a ministerial delegation. this in itself did not come, you know, it was, the ministerial delegation has, in itself is not a legal entity and it does not have legal status, particularly when linked with the PFMA, which may require that state institutions be listed in terms of the PFMA either as a Schedule 2 or a Schedule 3. So that's the biggest challenge of AgriMark, is that it doesn't have legal status, and that's largely what we seek to address here. The merit of AgriMark is to support and promote the process of integrated socio-economic development in South Africa within the context of the construction industry through the facilitation, the introduction, application, and utilization of satisfactory innovation and technology development in a manner that adds value to the process. AgriMark is positioned as an internationally acknowledged objective, I mean, that's the most important thing, an objective South African Center for the Assessment and Certification of Innovative, Non-Standardized Construction Products, Systems, Materials, Components, and Processes, which are not fully covered by the South African Bureau of Standards or Code of Practice. The objective of AgriMark South Africa, excuse me, is to provide assurance of fitness for purpose and value for money of innovation, non-standardized construction technology, as well as ongoing quality assurance. Essentially, that means that when a product is tested, it is tested against what the manufacturer says it would do. It works with the construction sector to facilitate the introduction of cost-effective, innovative, non-standardized construction technologies, disseminate correct, objective, and relevant information to all concerned in respect to technical, socio-economic, and regulatory aspects of innovative, non-standardized construction technology. It supports policymakers at all levels to minimize the risks associated with the use of new innovations and support the application of the National Building Regulation. This is very important that it's linked to the international peer organizations and supports the South African construction industry in the export activities by facilitating the approval of South African innovative construction products into foreign countries. So essentially what this speaks to is if a product is certified by AgriMark South Africa and that product, there's a demand for the product in France, because of the reciprocal standards which are set internationally, AgriMark certifies it in South Africa. That means the product can be easily exported to a foreign country where an AgriMark exists. It facilitates the acceptance of innovative products within the context of government's new priorities and policies, and this we have seen already, particularly within the school build program. It serves the national interest but internationally acknowledged as an objective and independent South African center, serving the building and engineering communities by providing assurance to specifiers and users via technical approval of fitness for purpose of innovative non-standardized construction technology. Now, the reason for the need to establish AgriMark as a public entity is one is that, as I mentioned earlier, it does not have a legal status, so it is dependent on currently the CSIR to fulfill its administrative requirements and to manage technical agency. And more importantly, over the last few years, the AG, Director General, has been classifying transfers to AgriMark South Africa as irregular expenditure. And that's one of the fundamental issues that we need to address in this process, hence the need to establish it as a public entity. The draft AgriMark business case was developed, motivating for the establishment of AAD as a juristic person, and submitted to the Joint Evaluation Committee for approval in March 2013. So I'll very briefly run through the business case, because I think we've touched this quite extensively previously in our earlier presentation. What the business case speaks to in terms of format, it speaks about the situation analysis, the problem statement, the needs analysis, the delivery options, governance issues, and recommendations on appropriate service delivery more options. The purpose of the consultation is to do essentially a SWOT analysis, which will lead to a situation analysis and then to determine where the synergy exists between AgriMark and other public entities, is there a duplicate in function, and if there is a need for ASA to exist in its own independent space, or whether AgriMark should reside within another entity. Now, these are all the checks that we need to comply with and ensure that address in the business case. Repeatedly, these are the stakeholders we've targeted, and these are the institutions that have a direct relationship with AgriMark, which is DGI, particularly SEV and the NRCS, Department of Human Settlement, as well as the National Home Builders Registration Council, an entity of human settlement. At that point, it was the Department of Corporate Governance and the South African Local Government Association, the Department of Science and Technology, and within that, its entities, the CSIR. And what I want to mention here is that the recommendation that came through was the synergy between AgriMark and TIA. And I will speak to that a little later. We've consulted CBE, the CIDB, South African Revenue Services. This is largely due to the import and export issues that we were referring to earlier. And in summary, this is the outcome of the consultation, is that there's a need for ASA to retain its mandate and to continue to exist as a separate independent organization, and this is in line with international trends. A proposal for the extension of AgriMark's mandate to include a regulatory function. This we intend to do as a future action. And what DGI raised as a concern when we were discussing, when we were in consultation with them, was that we must ensure that in the regulatory role, that we do not infringe on any of the WTO provisions, specifically when it relates to issues of health, safety, and environment. So that matter has been flagged, and we will address that as developed regulation for AgriMark South Africa. The impact of the policy position is the irregular expenditure concerns raised by the AD will be addressed. AD will be able to effectively promote the value of certification of non-standardized construction materials and systems, thus promoting innovation and local manufacturing and job creation in the construction sector. Increased availability and reliability of non-standardized material. This will hopefully have an impact in lowering construction costs to the public and the private sector. Through international engagements, ASA will ensure that South African assessment standards remain internationally accepted, thus facilitating its export of crafts and materials to other countries. And I think this is very important because already there's been a huge demand for the services of AgriMark within Africa itself. Now, Chairperson, the last time we presented was up to that point when we said that the draft bill was being drafted. Subsequently, we have a draft bill in place, which speaks to the objects of AgriMark, the powers and functions of AgriMark, the certification and renewal of the certification process, the essential component keeping of a register of all certified products. We speak about the Board of AgriMark South Africa, and this is talking about its governance structure and in terms of its composition, in terms of office, disqualification and vacation of office of board members, remuneration and allowances of board members, and conflict of interest of board members. I think here we drew quite extensively from a number of pieces of legislation where we said to minimize the impact of any conflict of interest that may arise on board members. For way of example, we put in limitations that if you're a board member, you may not do business with AgriMark for a certain period of time. And that business goes further to include family members, and this is defined in terms of the Act. Now, the current status is Cabinet approved the ASA bill for public comments in December. It was gazetted on the 15th of January. We're currently in the process of receiving comments. I think today we received roughly about 11 comments. Nothing substantive so far. The only issues that were raised were issues of clarity, and which we will address to the individual writers post the comments. I think it's important to mention that if we had a flood of comments, which should have come through by yesterday, then we would hold workshops to address specific issues. But if it still remains as of yesterday morning, which was around 11 comments, then, and because it wasn't substantive, we were thinking we may no longer need to have workshops on the board. And that actually helped us speed up the process. The issues that I have not touched yet is we went through an extensive consultation with the chief state law advisor. They had a number of comments that they raised for the bill because we allow Agrimark to raise funds as well, to charge fees for such services. So at one point they considered the money bill, which required us to now consult with treasury and other legal, get other legal opinions. At point of getting, we are very comfortable that the bill was extremely tight, it was sound all aspects, and that if we have no serious policy issues, we would be able to successfully table it by September 24th into cabinet for approval. We took into account the election period, and hence we have to delay it by 2 months. So hence about September 2014. So, Chairperson, do you want me to stop here, or should we continue with all of the... Continue, okay. I'll hand over. Good.
Chairperson, on the expropriation bill, to follow the extensive presentation that we did to the portfolio committee late last year, so this is basically an update of where we are. Just to recap, the proposed expropriation bill really seeks to align the Expropriation Act 1975 with the Constitution and to provide a common framework to guide processes and procedures for expropriation of property by all organs of state. Very importantly, the bill does not seek to interfere with the powers of expropriation conferred by specific legislation, but rather to prescribe uniform procedures to be followed by all expropriating authorities when exercising those powers. The bill therefore seeks to introduce measures that differ significantly from the existing Expropriation Act to blunt the 75 Expropriation Act is typical of its era, and it basically says that the responsible minister may expropriate as he pleases. In the expropriation bill, noteworthy is the recognition and compensation where valid of unregistered rights in properties where previously unregistered rights were not recognized. On the issue of powers of expropriation, as we've said before, the bulk of expropriating authorities derive their powers from other pieces of legislation. So in the draft expropriation bill, it merely seeks to confirm the power of the Minister of Public Works to expropriate property for purposes connected to the execution of his or her mandate. The bill therefore does not grant expropriating powers to any other functionaries, but rather prescribes uniform procedures to be followed by such appropriating authorities. In short, the aim is therefore to introduce consistency and uniformity in the way that organs of state undertake the expropriation of property in order to prevent lengthy and costly litigation. Just to highlight, in contrast to the 75 Act, the proposed expropriation bill embodies the constitutional principle of just administrative action by, amongst other measures, providing for the publication of the intended expropriation, incorporating a rationale for such expropriation, providing for notices of intended or actual expropriation, again incorporating the rationale to be served or delivered to all known affected persons, and importantly, affording interested parties an opportunity to raise objections and make representations to an expropriating authority before a final decision is taken. In the development of the bill, the department sought advice from various prominent legal practitioners on specific constitutional and practical matters relating to expropriation. Bill was gazetted for comment in March 2013, and really wide-ranging submissions were received from all corners, organized agriculture, commerce industry, financial sector, legal fraternity, property industry, public entities, government departments, but most importantly also from members of the public. following further consideration of these comments, a revised bill was submitted to NEDLAC, and a joint task team of the Trade and Industry and Development Chambers considered very thoroughly the bill and completed its deliberations in November of 2013 with relatively few areas of disagreement. In fact, there are no areas of disagreement where the labor community and business constituencies unanimously oppose any provisions in the law. On the issue of the impact of the new Expropriation Act, once enacted, we argue that the implementation of the uniform procedures should not have a significant impact on the staff structures of expropriating authorities. Some existing personnel may, however, require initial training on the new procedure. And in this regard, the Department of Public Works will establish capacity to provide guidance on the new procedures to all expropriating authorities. The bill is currently being finalized in consultation with the Office of the Deep State Law Advisor, and we will shortly be seeking Cabinet's approval to table the bill in Parliament. Thank you.
Just to note, there's a timetable for seeking Cabinet approval and submitting it to Parliament.
We actually were on the point of taking it to the Cabinet Committee last week, but there were some minor issues that the State Advisor raised, which he thought were valid. So we will be going to the Cabinet Committee next week, and we're pretty sure that we'll get Cabinet Committee approval next week, or Cabinet then, because Cabinet would need to sign off on the following week. And our expectation and hope is that Cabinet would then approve it for tabling in Parliament. Clearly that does mean, Chairperson, that this Parliament unfortunately will not be able to, we won't have the time to have public hearing on it, but we do want to put down a clear marker of the intention to move in this direction and also to provide reassurance about where we are heading in terms of the expropriation.
The Built Environment Professions Bill, you can recall, was tabled in Parliament in 2008, but later withdrawn from the NCOP, citing the need for further consultation. This was largely consultations within governments, commissions raised by Treasury and Department of Education, which were addressed. Subsequently, in 2011, the Department began a review again of the Built Environment Professions, and this led to an intensive interaction between the CBE, the Professional Councils, and DPW, culminating in the development of a new policy document titled Proposed Amendments to the Statutory Regulatory Framework of the Built Environment Profession. The policy document aims to review the BEP based on the following three principles, that is public protection, integrity of the profession, and government policy objectives. The following challenges we identified as the drivers for the need to review the built environment profession. One is the poor cooperation between CBE and the professional councils, poor oversight and lack of accountability by professional councils, inadequate regulation, lack of alignment to government policy planning, lack of transformation, gaps in the registration process, and the cost of investigating complaints. In addressing these challenges, there were various options that were put forward and were tested. The first option was the single CBE with six professional boards, very similar to the first bill that we tabled. It was often referred to as the establishment of a super council. Both environment professional councils Axia will largely be appealed and the Burton Government Professional Council will be converted to professional board, accountable to the council. This option restructured the current system to provide a standardized regulation for the built environment profession. This option was not the preferred option by BEPC's and some government departments, and largely National Treasury and NGST. The second option we looked at was CV and the six professional council remain as seven entities by the amended legislation. Basically, the current situation will remain as you would have a flat structure, where you have the minister that regulate the built environment professional council as well as CBE. Now, what it provides is for the built environment professional councils to report through the CBE, but not accountable to the CBE. The second issue is that to amend seven pieces of legislation is quite a tedious process, and this option we found that even after the amended legislation, you will largely have status quo remain where you will have this, you will not deal with many of the substantive issues, particularly on the challenges of CBE and professional council.
Mr. Dilebe, before proceeding, can you elaborate on the flat structure, the flat structure, what are you doing about them? Because CBE, they can report to CBE, but they are not accountable to CBE. Can you elaborate on that?
Chairperson, if you read the of the CBE and the Sikh Professional Council, essentially CBE played a coordination facilitation role. It was envisaged at the time of drafting of the legislation is that CBE would play this overarching role over the birth environment profession, particularly amongst the 13 areas that it regulates. For example, professional registration, recognition of prior learning, registration processes, etc. It was envisaged that CBE would develop a policy framework. Each of the professional councils would then develop their own individual policies and then processes for each of those areas. Now, what has happened over the period of time is that that relationship did not work ideally. And it's largely because of the way legislation was drafted. Because while we envisage this overarching role, each professional council in its act reports to the Minister of Finance. So if CBE requests for something, the professional councils themselves, and correctly so, would argue that we do not report to the Minister. So that created the one intent. And the second thing that was most profound for us is that the structure of the CE in its design is problematic. What we did was we requested each of the professional councils to identify two representatives to serve on the council with the sort of the Burton Government, in addition to state and public representatives. Now, when you do that, the council members, when they sit on CBE, have a fiduciary duty to ensure the effective running of CBE. But what you found was these representatives that came through from the professional council, they're usually your president and your vice president. And they were of the view that when they came to CBE, they were representing their individual profession. So because of that arrangement, you found that CBE itself as an institution often deadlocked on any matter if a particular council felt that it was not receiving a fair share or an equal representation. Let me give you by way of example. You've got the SAC Club, the landscape architect, a very small professional council. It only has less than 200 members. So it struggles financially. So CBE at one point offered to partly fund it. The minute CBE offered to do that, the other professional councils, and these are, I'm talking about ASRAs, the SICA, extremely rich institutions that even own assets, said it's unfair, we want to see no more. So when you have situations that are rising, you find that the individual role of CBE becomes locked in terms of it's not able to deliver on its mandate. So we found that even if you amend legislation, you're still going to have that problem. And if that chairperson refers to the legislation, where all seven institutions, the six professional councils and the CBE, all report to the minister. And that's just by design in terms of the legislation. But that's fundamentally what we want to address in the proposed and the proposal that we are putting forward, which is the next option that we've considered, which is option three. Now, in here you will see that we say that CBE plays the role of promotion, facilitation, and coordination of the built environment profession. We are arguing that this function be relocated within DCR. The current professional council legislation will be amended to address current shortcomings and should then tighten up the relationship between the professional council and the minister as a normal party chair. This was the option that was preferred in advance by the department as its own policy position. Now this is how the reasons for the position of the preferred option. One is the authority of professional council to be derived directly from the minister. So the professional council will have a one-on-one relationship with the minister. They will also be able to work as a collective through agents at DPW, so they will speak at a single voice, or get a single instruction, or get a single point of entry to the department. The functions of CDE will be reframed within DPW. As I mentioned, the council reports to the minister. There will be a saving, largely the council, the saving of that they will incur by the functioning of the current CDE. More importantly is there will be improved synergies between DPW and the professional council. But this will also lead to further savings because we currently have an antagonism that goes on where you end up often with among CB and professional council, we have been taking when you take each other to court. We have already had situations that we have to address. It will remove any duplication in function because this will be addressed with legislation as well as the mandate of DPW. DPW will ensure, and this is most important, DPW will be able to ensure that the built environment professional councils give effect to the mandate. Now, you will recall one of the core issues, the core mandate of the professional councils is to investigate any professional, if there's any allegations leveled against a professional for any form of misconduct. To this date, we have no serious investigations taking place. In Pretoria alone, we have 4 malls that collapsed, all of the same problem, structural damage to the foundation, or structural damage to the first floor, very similar to the Tungat incident. We're not having the investigation by access to date. And no one was held accountable. So we need to have this, we need to ensure that this takes place. CBE is empowered to a certain point in this regard, but it can only deal with the appeal process. But for the appeal process to take place, it means there has to be a year in front of the professional council. If these kinds of mandates of the department will be able to deliberately and actively drive in terms of public protection, in terms of public safety and health issues and environmental issues.
Just clarify, when you said there's
been an investigation by the council. That's not to say there's been other investigations.
Thanks, yeah, yes, that's from it's by AXA.
The engineering council.
Yeah. In addressing this process, we will repeal the CBE Act and we will amend regulations of the Board of Environment Professional Council.
Continue. You touched on AXA. I want all of us to benefit out of this so that we can be able to engage. The accreditation by accreditation, AXA Yes, internationally. Does it benefit engineers in South Africa? Because I'm asking this question because if you remember this Washington Accord, that does not allow Cubans, if I'm going to say, correct me, to work in South Africa. I want you to touch on the issue of today, are they not the guys as South African engineers benefiting out of that? Benefiting out of that? Are there no blockages? Are they? You heard me.
Chairperson, if I can, let me respond to that. Firstly, AXA regulates the profession. So in order to practice as an engineer in South Africa, you have to be registered with AXA. You start as a candidate, you go to your candidacy, and then you will register in the relevant category depending on your academic qualification. So that is the first prerequisite. You must be registered with AXA to practice in the profession. Now, what the Washington Accord, the Dublin Accord, etc. does, it gives South Africans the opportunity to practice in certain countries without necessarily acquiring accreditation in those countries. So, in one way, it is certainly beneficial because a South African can work in UK and vice versa. That's what they of course do. It's a country that have a very similar standard of education and similar registration requirements are allowed to practice in the respective countries. So you, in one way for me, it opens up the opportunities for South African professionals to work internationally. That's the one element. You must also realize that in those countries, you can come to work in South Africa. Now the Cuban issue is a little bit different.
Why are you saying actually you can come and work in South Africa?
No, I know, I don't need those factors. South Africans can work in those countries that are signatories to the Washington Accord or the Dublin Accord. And then those members of from those countries can work in South Africa. It's just a reciprocal agreement that they have the same standard they're able to get it. Now the problem with the Cubans is that they are not part of the Washington Accord or Dublin Accord or one of the other accords, where they are recognized as having the same level of qualifications as South Africa. Now, there are a number of solutions to that. One is those professionals will need to apply in South Africa and follow the normal process, which is quite tedious, because in South Africa you get like 8 years before you can actually become a professional engineer, if you're fortunate. Alternatively, is for South Africa to enter into an agreement with Cuba, and that's a little bit more of a political / technical area where you would need to reach agreements in terms of qualifications, in terms of skill, in terms of capacity, in terms of training, etc., etc. So, to answer the question directly, the Cubans working in South Africa and the Washington Accord, there's no direct relationship because Cuba is not a signatory to the Washington Accord. What prevents the Cubans from working in South Africa is the requirement of registration by ACFA.
Question you're asking, not just about Cuban, but of course, I think it raises the bigger issue. Are the standards that we have, engineering qualification standards, are they appropriate to the developmental profile of South Africa? Just leave aside the Cubans, countries that are doing extremely well in terms of engineering, industrialization, South Korea, let's take that example. Their engineers would also not qualify in South Africa. They would have to go through the same TD process. So I'm mentioning South Korea, so we don't get into it. It looks like it's an ideological issue. And that's because I think in many developing countries, what they've said is that you don't need the same, you know, they qualify engineers in very specific targeted areas rather than having to have a broad spectrum of areas of qualification. So I think that's a big issue going into the future that we do need to pose to ECSA, in other words, because we haven't got the engineers that we require. And is that because we're expecting them to be American engineers or British engineers, countries that are highly developed and so forth? Or do we want effective engineers, but not necessarily engineers that can do engineers that are very qualified for specific targeted function and so on. So I think that's an important issue, and again, and that then relates to the topic that's under discussion here, which is how do we raise these issues politically in a much more direct way with, for instance, the Engineering Council of South Africa. I think we have a good rapport. And at the moment, part of the problem is that between the department seeking to raise these issues and the Engineering Council is something that sits between, which is the CEE. So it becomes a much more messy process. And we find that where we have a direct engagement with the Engineering Council, to take that example, we make good progress, and there's a good understanding from their side. Obviously, it's interests that they've kept, but also good understanding. And so that's really what we're trying to achieve, a more direct relationship between the political priorities we have as a country, which as a department we should seek to champion, and the profession, recognizing their professional skills, which we don't have, and their professional knowledge. But often that professional knowledge and skills are sort of located in a Dublin or Washington space rather than a brick space, you know, or whatever we want to say. That's the challenge, and structural things that we're talking about now we think will help to have a discussion. One respect, it's not a question of treating the professional councils, whether it's engineering, architect, as just obstructions, because they're not necessarily there. And we don't and we must respect their ethical and professional flaws. But at the same time, we oppose political questions, narrow ones, but political questions to them. So sorry, I'm using what I thought was a very helpful question. Just to expand a little.
I just want to thank the Deputy Minister. I think it was a full comment and help me to also try to understand, because there were various options there was. There was one with this, and an extra layer of accountability, extra layer of reporting, and then the other option was a flatter structure. And that actually reinforces what the Minister is saying, that it's professional people and they want to talk more directly to the politicians or to the government, and they don't want to go through another layer of bureaucrats or administration. So that is useful, and I think we maybe more direct interaction would be helpful in solving some of the obstacles that were in the way, or some of the perceptions that existed on both sides. I think direct as possible contact would be helpful.
Sure, thank you. I think that's more than just going to speak about the interaction between the department and the professional council being more direct is to address such issues. I mean, DM touched on, for example, the work that's been done in Africa. They're trying to create a forum of African engineers who go so that we can recognize within the continent itself the skills and capability. And those are some of the issues that you probably want to take forward on a practical level. So you, instead of just having the Washington Accord, you'll have a very similar accord for Africa as we move forward. And we know that ACTA has been working on this for a little while now. Okay, so in terms of largely speaking to the issues of alignment to government policy and planning, the governance issue, there'll be no competing interest between CBE and the professional councils. We call it example I use of the CBE, where you have representatives on the professional councils on the CBE with competing interest. That will be addressed. The accountability will be a direct one between the professional councils and the Department of Public Works. And I use the Department of Public Works, it's actually ministry, because by legislation will be accountable to the Minister of Public Works. We will be addressing the issue of poor cooperation, because this will be addressed largely to the issue of through remaining legislation to clearly define the role of the department, the professional councils, and to clearly define the role and mandate of the minister as well in this regard. Oversight, as I mentioned, will be directly by DPW, and governance matters will be addressed firmly within DPW. The issue of lack of transformation is a matter that DPW will drive directly. We already have a number of initiatives in place, the DPW Skills Development Strategy. There's also very soon to be released a document by CIDB called the Skills Development Agency. The CBE is working on the transformational framework. So collectively, all of these documents within the mandate of DPW will give effect to the issue of transformation. I think the Skills Development Agency document speaks a lot and intends to drive transformation through the opportunities of training opportunities to build environment professions. And lastly, we will ensure consistent application of policy to this option. The current basis, in finalizing the draft bill, we've consulted with the CBE, that's the council. We've consulted with CBE staff, as well as the Built Environment Professional Council. We've addressed some of the comments that have come through. Some comments we thought that are a little bit more detailed that we can address through regulations, so we'll attend to those regulations. But there's been no opposition so far from CBE or the Built Environment Professional Council to the position we advanced. There's a lot of issues of clarity that they were concerned with, so, and which you've addressed. Chairperson, we're hoping to have the draft policy presented for public comments by the end of February, first week of March. And a formal policy position by June. And once that's been approved, then we'll go into the whole legislative program thereafter. Okay, can I move on to the IDT? The next issue is the Independent Development Trust, which was established in 1990 as an independent civil society temporary grant-making agency with a 2 billion rand grant. Endowments to be invested with the returns utilized to achieve IDT's primary goal, which was to enable disadvantaged communities to access resources and to recognize and unlock their potential. This we're quoting directly from their trust deed. So essentially it was a DFI, it was given 2 billion rand, it was to invest 2 billion rand, use the interest to maintain the organization and to fund development in townships. In March 1997, Cabinet endorsed a recommendation by the Cabinet Advisory Committee that, in this area, stated the IDC must be transformed into a governed development agency that will implement projects which are commissioned by government departments. It must cease to be a civil society organization, an independent agency, or a funding agency. So this largely changed the IDC's mandate from a DFI to a development institution, providing infrastructure. With the establishment of the National Development Agency in 1997, IDC transferred 100 million to the NDA to continue the facilitation but etc. that the NDA was to undertake. Now, in October 2001, the trust was admitted to make provisions for the appointment of new trustees. Its goal and objectives was to complement government's national development policy and priority, and ensuring cooperation with government development agencies and private sector. Its primary goal was to use its resource together with strategic partners in ways which, in the opinion of the trustees, would best serve to enable poor communities in the Republic of South Africa to access resources, recognize and unlock their own potential, so as to continuously improve the quality of life. Now, essentially between 1998 and 2005, IDC began to play the facilitation role. It received no additional funding from government. And later on, it charged nominal fees, and this adversely impacted on its financial position. The IDC's current strategic objective, as it said, is to address the ongoing needs for a community-oriented development agency that is able to support the efforts of all spheres of government, with development specialists and expertise in implementation of projects at community level. So this is office of government, includes local government. It has capacity internally that folks that have developmental expertise, and most importantly, it does the social facilitation, which ensures community participation. The second objective is to facilitate, contribute, and integrate the efforts of all spheres of government and leverage efforts of the private sector and civil society in support of community development, particularly in the delivery and maintenance of social infrastructure. The third one is to contribute to a long-term vision of a consolidated development agency, which plays program and project management role for all government development initiatives. Now, that is more or less what IED is currently, current objective. But the problem statement is that one being that because IDC's mandate has changed, it has received no additional funding from the fiscus, this has eroded its capital base, which has put it in certain financial predicaments. In 2006, there is a financial modeling which indicated that it needed to recover money, and one was to was the introduction of the cost recovery mechanism. While the other sought to initiate a long-term development of a business case to determine the long-term sustainability of IDC. Now, while it introduced the cost recovery mechanism, it has not been able to successfully raise sufficient income to sustain itself. And what we are currently finalizing now is its long-term sustainability in the form of the business case. The current low levels of spending by spheres of government informs the need for, and this is important, for states to accelerate its capacity and ability to deliver social infrastructure. Hence, we're advancing for the argument for a state institution to play this role and to focus on social infrastructure. In addition, Cabinet established the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission to coordinate, integrate, and accelerate implementation of infrastructure, and to develop a single common national infrastructure plan beyond one administration to avoid a stop pattern to the delivery of infrastructure. Now, the IDC in this regard is the joint coordinator of Sub-13, which deals with the National School Build Program. Now, in order to determine the long-term sustainability of IDT, Chairperson, we had to follow a very similar process that we followed with the AGIMARC South Africa. We had to develop a comprehensive business case. So in this regard, as I touched on before, we have to do a SWOT analysis, we have to identify the delivery model, we have to establish whether there's a synergy between IDT and other state institutions, because we have recalled a number of state institutions that are playing in a very similar field as IDT, so we need to clear that out. But most importantly, we have to determine a very clear mandate and market space for IDT. So we began this process in late 2012, which we undertook our literature review, etc. And then during May and June 2013, we began consultations nationally. It was our intent to consult all nine provinces and around 63 more government departments, but we were not able to achieve that because, one, government departments were not available. Two is some of them just didn't honor meetings. Now, when you go from all the way to Limpopo and expecting a meeting and some government departments will reach for the meeting, just call it Catch 22, because you're not going to be just like that. So we couldn't do a follow-up consultation because those departments weren't able to come to consent. But largely we consulted about nine provinces, we consulted 60 provincial departments, three state institutions, and several national government departments. I think on slide 38, it's a breakdown of all the consultations that we've been through nationally. Now, the outcomes of the consultation was that what was identified was that IDT, all of the stakeholders we engaged, all to varying degrees, identified IDT's market space as the provider for social infrastructure. But having said that, they clearly identified roles for DPW and IDT. They proposed that one DPW responds to the clients, allocates projects to IDT, create oversight for the implementation of projects, and provide clients with feedback on projects. Now, the reason for this is you found in certain provinces, IET was found to be competing with provincial public works provincial public works with ten departments. And in certain provinces, you had a very good relationship between IET and the provincial public works department. And in other provinces, it was quite strange. The ideal role was they found a role for IDT. It's able to deliver social infrastructure, it's able to deliver it quickly, it's able to deliver it on time, but they needed to ensure the quality of the asset that was delivered was as per the specs, and at times that was a problem. Hence they requested that DPW plays that oversight role of ensuring quality of the infrastructure. It was largely advanced by most of the client departments, including national government departments, that IDT must become the implementing arm of DPW for the provision of social infrastructure. And I keep emphasizing the role of social infrastructure because we must not associate the function of IDT with that which is already performed by DPW National when we deliver major infrastructure, capital projects, because there's a clear distinction between the resources required for capital projects and what's required for social projects. The final thing that came through from the consultation is that IDT must develop internal capacity and skills to undertake projects. Now, while it may not become a constructor itself, but it must be able to have certain skills internally rather than outsource those skills. So those may be two issues of quantity surveyors or engineers or architects, etc. So in positioning IDT, we position it accordingly. The first is the part that IDT becomes a Schedule 3A public entity, which means it is funded directly by the fiscus. We are currently working on a model that will determine the flow of the project funds versus the flow of projects that are currently being developed. The following I'm going to explain through in terms of what has come up with the consultation and how we envisage things going forward in terms of its mandate. Client departments, that is whether the national or provincial or local, propose DPW, the social infrastructure that they require, and DPW then allocates the project to IDT. So this eliminates the need for IDT to market itself and find it for competing with provincial and national public works. DPW will play an oversight role in the execution of the project, but will critically be responsible for the issuing of the certificate of completion. Now this is what guarantees the quality of the asset. In some provinces, issues raised about the quality of the asset after it was produced. And then you had a challenge between where some of the assets could not be included in the asset register. So they wanted DPW to play that role from the beginning to ensure that the asset gets onto the asset register. An implementing protocol that clearly defines the roles and responsibilities between GPW, IDT, and crime departments, and this includes provincial public works and possibly local government, must be developed and defined. We will define it in the business case, but also in terms of when we drop in legislation. The above will fortify the IDT of the delivery arm of GPW, focusing on the provision of social infrastructure. And what's important is when IDT delivers social infrastructure, it can base in the delivery of the social infrastructure, community participation. And that, for me, is the competitive edge of IDT over any other institution. And that is a vital component in the delivery of any social infrastructure, because the value add and the multiplier effect of that is significantly important to the community, but also in terms of the economy, because people acquire skills, you create new economic opportunities, etc., which many of the other institutions are doing. So we position the delivery of social infrastructure within that context. And I mentioned that IDT will be, we position it to be a Schedule 3 public entity, so it's funded directly through the first group. We're advancing the argument that DPW through the IDT will address the development gap in terms of poverty eradication, particularly at the community level. It will advance social facilitation with marginalized communities to ensure effective empowerment of communities to drive the development agenda with a spread focus of health, education, and justice. And these are the main sectors that we find IDT would need to play a key role. It's in the delivery of health facilities, educational facilities, and your course. Now, what you found is, if you go to Eastern Cape, IDT has been extremely effective in delivering social infrastructure in deep rural areas where government has problems accessing. Now, those are important elements that we must take into account, because if it wasn't for that, we would not see delivering some of these areas. And these are highlighted by some of the social Department of Education and Department of Health in Eastern Cape. The IDT mandate as per the cabinet approval of 1997 remains unchanged. So we are not sharing IDT's mandate. We are clearly defining the role in which it plays and gives respect to that mandate. IDT will enable GPW to deliver on urgent and immediate infrastructure requirements and better address the development gap in poverty eradication at community level. Now, what we're talking about here is, at times you have an urgent need for a social asset to be developed. You may have a disaster where you may find a bridge has been washed away and you need an urgent need to develop. IDT is able to do that. It is able to respond to these issues very quickly and much faster than the state. So we thought that it would continue to play that particular role. Chairperson, that's largely the mandate that we've developed for IDT. And we are now at the point where we need to develop a human resource model, which is largely the structure of IDT, what the job description for each post, and then linked to that, we would need to develop a finance model. We're hoping to have this completed by March 2014. We've already started work on the HR model. We're working very closely with IDT to identify the expertise and the niche that they require in terms of their own capacity. And we're expecting that the financial model to take us about 3 weeks to finalize once we have the HR model. So our target is March 2014. We're hoping to submit that, and in fact this is a ministerial instruction, that by April 2014, we must have a business case that must go to the Joint Evaluation Committee. So we're hoping that the Joint Evaluation Committee will approve this, and then we can submit to Cabinet by the April, May, at the latest. So once we have that, then we start the process of legislation thereafter. Chairperson, that's the presentation now just on the legislative areas. Should we go to the Charter Council?
Anwar, can we engage on the legislation? Magri? Thank you very much. Mr. Pillay, Mayor Mary, thank you very much for this presentation. It was a so many issues on the side of the province. Remember, we raised all these things, and thank you, Deputy Minister. Wanya Mavila? Katamabala? Mama Magana? Anabunu Mwane? Baba Magwane? Ma November? as well.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation with regard to the progress that you've made with regard to the legislation, the processing of the legislation. But here, my worry is that, you know, the strategic plan is a problem for the period of 5 years. And also when aligning the strategic plan to the annual performance plan, and also the presentation to the committee. I think the information or the content of the strategic plan, the APP, and the presentation, it must be the same. Because when looking at the strategic plan, the date of the strategic plan, and also the APPs, they're not the same. You know, I'll just make one example. According to the first plan, it said IDT business case will be submitted for approval to the minister by 31st of March 2014. But when listening to your presentation, you are saying that it should be submitted by the end of April 2014. So in all this legislation, you are extending time. Mm-hmm. And Chairperson, this is the long outstanding, the issue of the legislation. I think it was a serious matter. It was long outstanding. Each and every time we keep on, you know, engaging the department. How far are you with this legislation? But, you know, when listening to the presentation, looking at your plan, your annual performance plan, you also keep on extending time. The other example, when looking at your plan, it says that you complete the draft build environment profession policy by the 31st of March 2013. Then says by 31st December 2013, you will submit the final draft to the minister for approval. Then you will table the Built Environment Profession Bill in Parliament by the 31st of March 2015. IDT. You have said that IDT business case will be submitted to the minister for approval by the 31st of March 2014 and the PMTA by the 31st of March 2014. By the presentation, looking at the plan and the presentation, you know, there's no finish, there's no alignment. On the expropriation, you indicated in the plan that you were expecting to table the expropriation by 30 June 2018. I think that is the plan, your plan. Then, looking again at the ASA, according to the plan, you said you will table the bill in Parliament by the date. Initially, it was by the 30th of June 2013. Then 31st of July 2013. Sharing, that is the problem that I'm having, because when looking at the plan and also, you know, the implementation part of it, it doesn't talk to each other. But what I've realized is that the data are being extended now and then. And also, what is the in the third plan and what is presented here about the deadlines and whatever. It's not the same issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think that has been covered by the previous speaker, because my concern, Chairperson, was the extension of off dates, because they are aware that our term is coming to an end. in April. But now they are playing by that scenario and situation. Because it is not the first time when we are complaining about this situation, because even during the time of Peter Chaperson, the complaints about this registration was there. Even during the previous minister. But now, because it is the end of our term, now everything is coming to the par. That's the potential person that I have. And another question is that one of, if you check on page 17, the president, on page 7, the establishment of this ASA, what I want to get the clarity on that one is the similarities of these entities between the ASA and the CSIR. They are not the same. The mandate of these two entities are not the same. If they are the same, what is the need of this of establishment of this ASA? And the other question is on page 13, Chair, they talk about the job creation, but there is no target. They say they are going to create jobs. How many jobs are they targeted for that? And then on page 15, Chair, the workshop. I have a concern about the workshop because according to the presenter, he says there is no need now for the workshop because of the law comment. But if you check, there was a target of February 2014. So what will happen to the routine comment? And the last one, Chairperson, is page 20. Let number 3. Where it says the chamber has completed its deliberation with the a few areas of disagreement recorded. I'm worried about this few areas of disagreement. What is going to happen? And the last one, and the last, page 37, the person. The report, bullet number two, it indicated that the consultation was not completed, was not finished. So what I want to find out is what's going to happen? Or what is the position of the department to those reports which was not, those consultation which was not consulted. What I'm trying to say. What I want to find out, Chair President, how many which are not were not consulted? Because according to them, they say nine provinces were consulted, but 15 provincial departments. And how many were not consulted? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my first question is on expropriation bill. Because it says the staff structure, the impact on the staff structure of expropriation bill. Now, what I want to know is about the financial implication on the expropriation bill itself, because now since this is a bill which is very, very important for the country as a whole. Secondly, on the same bill, when are they intending to, when is the cabinet intend to approve this bill? Because now, as my colleagues have already said, that we are now exiting, so we need a clear guidelines, especially on the dates, that when this thing is going to, when are they going to happen. On the build and environment profession,
on the current status that certain stakeholders were consulted. My main problem is that if they can also consult the students themselves, because they are the people who are suffering most when it comes to this CPE cancer. Because now the presentation is not clear whether they did consult some students who completed some certain courses at the university level.
My first question is around the bills. Each one of them, are you still going to come and present each, like maybe Agrima South Africa before? I don't know, because last time we were dealing with the expropriation and each one of them, are still going to come back to the committee and discuss extensively all the bills one by one? Or maybe just an overall discussion on all bills, because before they are passed. And then on the... on the CPE, just to check whether, because before that bill was passed, there were some public by the Mafolo Committee. It's just to check whether the issues that were raised during the public hearing, did you take or maybe did you go back to those to check whether the new bill is going to go according to those or will they be considered some of the issues that were raised? That was.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my colleague has covered me, but just also to ask the regional statement of Onga.com that open and finish, because people are really very much impatient outside there, especially about the expropriation bill. How open and finish? Mukui wanyo at the statement, how open and finish?
Yes, really,
we are in an official meeting, but the fairness is a problem for me. There is no agency, and people outside are impatient. We were around the provinces on hearings of the team, rural development. And if this isn't coming through the expropriation bill, then everything will be stayed still. I don't know what a person is understanding now. You understand me now? Yeah, that's all my colleagues have covered me.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page 4 on this presentation, the South African Bureau of Standards. Well, I wouldn't know about the agreements that the South African government has made with other countries. Shall I say European countries? I don't know. Because here you find a lot of low standard materials being received from overseas countries here and is being sold here at low prices. And at the same time, their lifespan is too short. For instance, congregated iron, zinc. Our people are buying that zinc and they are losing a lot of money because it doesn't last. And the South African Bureau of Standards is there. What do they say about this? What is their argument with foreign countries about the standards? Because I learned something here from a certain newspaper. the Chinese who have spoken to Mondi and Sapi, they want to buy posts from them and treat them and sell them to Republic. I know that they will be selling lost kind of material and it will affect our people. Where is South African standard, where is South African growth standard in that case? On page 32, IDT. I've got a feeling that the IDT is doing a lot of good things here in South Africa. More especially, on the issue of implementing school buildings. You can see all over the place where IDT has been building the school. They are very good. More especially in the Eastern Cape that you have mentioned. But now their problem is that in most cases they are being financed by the Department of Education to build these schools. Why can't they be provided with funds so that they can do their job properly without being supported by other people? Because you find that the education department will always say that we haven't got money, and at the end of the day, the rollover is over 6 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pillen, I want to take you back to the issue of engineering. I think we need to discuss this issue in depth for all of us to understand. After completion, our children undergo, let me say, practical, for me to understand better. But it takes them 8 to 10 years or never achieve what they wanted to achieve in life. Because there are blockages for them to become engineers. And we are told that some end up making tea in big companies, not giving that leverage of doing that practical work. To say, how is Department of Public going to deal with that issue? Because they are saying, last year, Honorable Rea raised a concern in one when we were discussing some of these things, to say we must leave professionals alone. And that cannot happen. Because we cannot allow our children not to end up being what they wanted to be. The issue of universities, accreditation of universities, to say which universities should our children be guided to go and study. Because children end up in universities that are not recognized. To say, how are we helping these children? What is the department doing? The issue of safety, health and safety management. Let's take the collapse of a building in Durban.
Yeah.
The collapse of that building. Where were the engineers? What happened? The quality of material that was used there. Are there no inspectors? I mean, some of these things I think in the legislation, the minister, they should be covered, some of these things, because we are dealing with a problem. We cannot my feeling is that South Africa cannot always depend on outside engineers. So say, Esakasa, what are we doing about this? Because it's an issue that needs to be attended to. Thank you.
On some of the general issues, because I think it's important that we take political responsibility for some of the issues rather than to dump the issues on our administrators, because I think some of the issues we must take political. So my colleague will deal with some of the detail better than I could. But I just want to talk about the main issue, which I think has caused a lot of frustration in the committee, and that's the delay. And the sort of, you know, we set deadlines, but then they shift backwards and so on. And I think, first of all, to say that I hope that, particularly since I've become the Deputy Minister, we've tried to keep you up to date on the matter and explain why, frustrating for us as well, there have been delays. So I hope that the date that we're producing now are not coming out of the blue through the Portfolio Committee, but we have been trying to indicate to you you know, that there are challenges or problems and whatever. So let me be, I think the first issue is that we all understand it, as our minister has been saying, this has been department in the IBU. We don't think we're in the ICU any longer, but I think a lot of the energy from basically the beginning of 2012, so halfway through your term as the portfolio committee, the new minister coming in late in 2011, but really only finding his feet in 2012, having focused on the corruption issues, the turnaround issues and so forth, and particularly the our asset register, our lease portfolio, all of those big challenges. I won't mention the N word, but you know what I'm referring to. There are a whole set of challenges that the department has been facing and we've conceded. And I think that under the leadership of the minister, but with the assistance of the senior management and the incoming DG, who's also new, we should acknowledge, I think that we've seen significant turnaround. There's a long way to go still, but I think it's a stabilized department. And that has meant that one of the areas that has suffered has certainly been in the policy legislature. Things were basically put on hold. So let's take the example of Agrimar. And I think I've said to this committee before that I'm partly responsible, let me say this up front, for the delay. Basically, what we've got now by way of a draft bill is where the policy section, they were ready 2 years ago, really, we're pretty much where we are now. An incoming minister and deputy minister, we said, hang on, this looks like government is saying, in general, we're creating too many entities. Entities outside of them. Are we really sure that we want now to formalize from our exist, but are we really sure that we want to, in legislation, set it up as independent entity? So we asked those political questions, and we were persuaded, actually, that we'd like where we're going now. But that caused delay. So there would be one example. On the expropriation bill, remember that in 2008, there was, coming from the department, an expropriation draft bill. And it was unconstitutional, frankly, in my view, in my judgment. And so at the last minute, where we are now in this administration, in the last months of that previous administration, it was suddenly drawn, withdrawn. Okay. And I think that ever since then, and until we injected new dynamism into the process, and that really started, Andre, I think, in mid-2012, late 2012, it was like this prickly pear that no one wants to touch. It was a expropriation thing, there's something wrong with it, it's controversial and so on. And so it was kind of just, and again, there was no political guidance given to the colleagues in the department. So they've been working on it. I mean, Andre has been working on it for, I don't know how many years. He was well aware of the shortcomings of the previous draft. So it was only late in 2012 that we could pick up the momentum, for instance, on the expropriation end. And I could go on and on. So what I'm trying to say is that because of the difficulties and complications in the department, and the focus in terms of turnaround being around leases, asset register, and I think correctly so, because that's the heart of our business, and if we don't know what we're doing in that space, then we're wide open to more ongoing corruption. So I'm keeping a little bit of mitigation for an understanding. I know it's frustrating for us, and that's frustrating for the committee. We're saying the legislation's coming, policy's coming, and it takes whatever. So now we're finally saying it's basically come. Okay, but we're out of time. So on the Agrimar thing, we exported formally with Parliament whether we could push it, because it's ready to go, and we don't have the controversial piece of legislation for. And we were told basically that it's not a priority piece of legislation. So that's frustrating, but we understand that given priorities that Parliament has to sit with a few months left now. Well, literally, we're now looking at a month. That's all we've got as Parliament, because we're going through it. So we'd love to have come with the Agrimar bill to yourself now rather than later, because we want to accomplish things on this front. What we have accomplished is that Cabinet has approved of it for public comment. The public comment is not problematic from what the government's reporting. So if we had another 6 months, another 3 months as a portfolio committee with Salesforce, bearing in mind also that there would have to be an NCOP process as well. It's not the section 76, but nonetheless. So that's the frustration. So we apologize for it. We apologize to ourselves because we would want it. On the Expropriation Act, I'm glad that Haluk is raising the matter. You see, look, I think that numbers of people, including some of my colleagues in government, are pretending that they can't expropriate because there's not an expropriation, a new expropriation. That is completely not true. Okay? There's a 1975 expropriation. And we've used it, and we use it all the time. 10 national departments, including Land Affairs, Rural Development and Land Affairs, have that minister has expropriating powers. But there are 9 other ministers, including our minister, that has expropriating powers. Every single province, Premier, has expropriating powers. Every single municipality has expropriating powers. For the moment, those expropriating powers are governed by the 1975 Expropriation Act. Okay, which is brutal, actually, and it's unconstitutional. So if you simply use that, and not, but there are a whole lot of other legislation for different line departments and also which give ministers and premiers and so on expropriating power. So that can expropriate, and they do expropriate. Expropriate on behalf of ESCOM, expropriate for, you know, putting power lines and so on. The other illusion that floats around, and I heard the leader of the opposition in Parliament last year in the State of Nation address tell us that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights says that it has to be willing seller, willing buyer. That's complete nonsense, frankly. There's no such thing in the Bill of Rights, willing seller, willing buyer. It says that the Bill of Rights, the property clause, which as far as I'm concerned could also be called an expropriation clause, under the right, because this describes how expropriation should occur. And it says there should be compensation, but it doesn't say the compensation should be R1, but it has to be just and equitable compensation. And one of the criteria is the market value of the property, but it's not the main criteria or the only criteria. All the other things, how the property was initially acquired, the use that it's been put to, and so on. So there's no willing seller, willing buyer thing. So people who say, colleagues who, and I hear it a lot, but as you've heard it, go around in problems and people say, you know, land reform can't go ahead because we haven't got an expropriation act or we've got to do willing seller, willing buyer. It's nonsense. Okay. Frankly, it's nonsense. They're all the powers in the world. But, and I think this is why there is some hesitation, why we are anxious to get this act through, and we apologize that we haven't succeeded in getting it through now, in this parliament, is that people are, in some cases, nervous of using their existing appropriating powers because they're worried that there will be constitutional challenges. And that's why we are trying to develop a bill, and we've been briefing you on this, which describes a process, a just administrative process. That will guide courts. For instance, here's a challenge. The courts will be able to say, here's legislation which describes, in line with the Constitution, a just administrative process to expropriate. So I think please, our colleagues from different political parties hit the road around the election. Don't assume responsibility as this portfolio committee because we haven't succeeded in bringing in a new expropriation act. For slowness in terms of transformation or land reform and so on. It's simply not holding a bank. This would help us because we get confidence that if we're taken to court as expropriators, we can say, because for the moment the courts are just guided by the Constitution in this matter, well, and other legislation, but primarily in terms of the just process. So that's what we're trying to do. I just thought it was important, Chairperson, to make that point clear. So we would love to, as I say, have completed the legislation that we've set ourselves out to do. I think we've done well. Well, the colleagues have done well under a lot of pressure. Very short stop, by the way, in this section. Have done well in basically the AgriMont, the IDT, and the expropriation. They're ready to go. So hopefully we will all be re-elected, and we'll all be back in public works. That's what we want. And so we'll be able to then complete the work that, frustratingly, we weren't able to quite finish off. So apologies, but hopefully also there's an understanding for the background for that. And I think important progress has been made on these fronts. But you're right to say, but you set the target for them, and I think that's the job of a portfolio company to keep the pressure on us, because it's easy for us to sit back into our comfort zones and so on. So I just wanted to make a broad political point, but my colleagues will be much better on some of the specific issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, GM. Mr.
Chair
and Mr.
Nering.
Time for you to respond.
Chairperson, further to what the Deputy Minister has explained on the expropriation bill, there were two questions that I thought I might be able to just elucidate. There was a query on the few areas of disagreement in the NEDLAC task team that dealt with the expropriation bill. Could we just confirm that the full report of NEDLAC will be submitted to the Portfolio Committee and will be part of the deliberation when we bring the bill to Parliament. The areas of disagreement are quite technical, so there will be adequate opportunity to engage, and believe me, those parties that did it with government on the expropriation bill will be here in force to endeavour to convince you of their points of view. Then on the issue of cost implications. The presentation made reference to the fact that we don't regard the new processes to be such that it would heavily impact on the self-complement of expropriating parties. But I think the question might have been referring to the issue of compensation. Now, as we know, the formula, if you wish, for compensation is laid down in the Constitution. The property clause, as referred to by the Deputy Minister. The bill sticks religiously to the Constitution. We have not endeavoured to put in place any other regime to determine compensation. The Constitution talks about just and equitable compensation, taking into account all factors, and all factors including the market value of the property. So the bill sticks to that, and therefore there should be no impact at all on the issue of compensation on budgets of government.
Mr. Clay?
There's a number of them. We try to go through them by each speaker. I think one of the issues that were raised was the relationship between AgriMark and CFIR, and they are similar, and there's no need for AgriMark. That is correct. We have in the business case undertaken this specific exercise, look at AgriMark in relation to a number of other institutions. Now, what AgriMark does is it's an institution that tests fit for purpose innovative construction products and materials. Now, as any institution that does the testing, there'll be a direct conflict of interest if that institution also produces the product. So you will recall that even in CERB, the South African Bureau of Standards, they only do the development of standards. Products are not innovated in there. Now, in CSIR, a lot of innovation happens within the built environment unit of CSIR, and CSIR in general. So if we absorb the function of AgriMark into CSIR, you will find that the CSIR will be performing two functions. One is the development of new innovative technologies, which currently does, but also the new role that will take over from AgriMark, which is the certification of the product. That in itself will create a direct conflict of interest in that particular institution. You cannot be seen as player and referee at the same time. So that's the reason for distinguishing AgriMark outside of CIR. the issue on job creation is no targets. That's correct. The what is advancing here is a policy position, and we're advancing the following. That if we establish Agrimark as its own institution, its own entity, it will have its own resources. It will then begin to play in the field of innovation within the construction sector. And we're hoping that through that awareness, through the conferences, through workshops that hold that innovation, it will begin to play a facilitation role. And that is bringing the various role players in the innovative field, including being TR on board, the Technical Innovative Agency of ST, Department of Science and Technology. And what we're hoping, this will spur a whole new industry within the construction industry. That is the new innovative industry, and that which will entail lots of R&D. And within, if that industry spurs, then you will get job creation taking place. It's within that policy thinking that we're advancing the argument of job creation. So the last question was, what will happen to the workshops that we presented on work environment professions? We said we intend to have, Agrimark South Africa. We intend to have workshops on, at the end of February. What is advanced is that so far we only have 11 written comments. All of the comments were more clarity-seeking comments rather than content issues or on the actual function or merit of Agrimark. We will respond to each of the writers addressing their particular query or concern. The problem is, if we decide to have a workshop and there's only 10 respondents in writing, and probably in attendance we'll probably get far less. And then the challenge becomes, it becomes fruitless and waste of expenditure if you're accommodating for the X number of persons and you only end up with 5 or 4 people. So we're trying to balance that off. What we have done though is we've put out a call for the workshop. We've requested for RSVPs by the 21st of February. That would depend on whether we continue with the workshop or not. If it's less than 10, we will hold it internally at DPW. If it's more than that, then we'll probably hold it outside. But if it's around 2 to 3 people, then we'll probably just respond to them in writing. That'll prevent wasteful expenditure. The last question was on IDT, and the question was, who was not consulted? What we have done is we've identified a number of stakeholders at the provincial level. These were largely infrastructure delivery institutions. These were the provincial Department of Public Works, Department of Education, and largely Department of Health. We established meetings in all provinces, and we had a single day in each province to meet all departments. Now, what we found is in some provinces, not all departments pitched up, but the consultations could take place. But we had, if there was, for example, the Department of Education representative had not attended the meeting, we had received input from the Department of Public Works that deals with education. So to a large extent, we addressed the content issues. We did not physically have met the official responsible for that. The provinces that we had not consulted was the Free State and Western Cape, simply because of time. We were under time pressure to produce the first report, so we couldn't secure meetings in time to have meetings with those provinces. But what we've drawn from is that the consultation that we've held so far in the provinces is largely what came through, and there have been marginal differences, if any, in the other provinces. We think we had a fairly decent representation in kind of finding out what the key issues for the business is. The next question was on consultation with students on the built environment professions. Once we put the bill out for public comment, which should be very soon, we, as part of that consultation, we then begin to consult universities and students and lecturers, etc. The last time when we had done this exercise, we had a lot of comments from academic institutions. So they're certainly part of the consultation. In fact, we had a number of students that wrote personally to the committee themselves and expressed certain views. So we will certainly target those students, those academic institutions. Present East Berlin Parliament,
Well, I think that, I mean, we could certainly, once Cabinet has approved the bills, and particularly if one thinks particularly of the expropriation bill, it would be no harm in us if there's time, and that would be a matter of a discussion between the chair of the committee, whether it would be any useful. Obviously, you can't protest the bill, you haven't got the time, and that would be the expectation. But if there would be an interest in us presenting it to the committee just for familiarization and an understanding of what has changed since we last presented it to you, and had a challenge, we'd be very, very happy to do that. But I think that's for the committee to decide on whether, and we could do the same with the agrimark as well. But bearing in mind that you wouldn't be able to, wouldn't be a case of public hearings, and would just be information. So we're available to do that. But I think it could depend on your progress.
Okay. The issue that was raised was whether the current revised policy took into account the comments that were raised previously during the portfolio committee hearings on the bill. Most of those comments were taken into consideration this time around. A lot of those comments that came through the last time around during the portfolio committee presentation were issues of clarity that sought to get a better understanding of what would be the impact of A against B. And those issues will be largely addressed through the policy document. I think the issue on sales and the importation of poor quality products, that is certainly one of the issues that is picked up in this process as a serious gap. The South African Bureau of Standards sets a standard for a particular product, but you must have three or four of those products in the market space to set a standard. So if there's only one product in the market space, you cannot set a standard for one product. That's when the product goes to AgriMark to get certified fit for purpose. Sorry, I'm limiting the discussion to just construction material and the construction system. So if you have three or four of a similar product in the market space, then you can start developing a standard. Now, even if you have a standard, unless it becomes a compulsory standard, you can bring any other product into a market space. So you will market a product, but you won't get the SABS certification. And that is one of the serious gaps that we picked up in the construction industry. I think the only product that has a compulsory standard is cement. All other products don't necessarily have a compulsory standard. Now the intent is, I did mention, once we have the AgriMark legislation passed to Parliament, we will begin to draft regulation. In fact, as it's about to pass, we begin to draft regulation. And that is one of the areas we want to plug. Because we want to advance the position that for a construction product to be used in the construction industry, it must either have SABS certification or AgriMark certification. So you have a level of comfort in terms of the standard. But having said that, we cannot do that for every single product. We can do it for all the products that have bearing on health, safety, and environment. By way of example, would you really need to have SABS certification for door handles or for aesthetic features? So we would need to determine which are these areas, which are the products, probably through a schedule, determine which ones must be every month certified as SABS approved. We've had discussions on this. We will certainly start, once the legislation does, start developing regulations on this matter. Chairperson.
Thanks. No, I think the clarity that the committee needed to understand was on the issue that whether the Agri SA will have inspectors going around or what is the purpose. These products, they come into the country and nobody says anything. It's only after they've been used by the end user that they discover that, no, they understand. Secondly, like the issue of houses that were demolished by the Human Settlement Department. Because all those were unsanitary. It has to understand how does it work. Will they have inspectors going around, or what is the issue? What is this? How are they going to work to take that Understood.
Can I make a follow-up on appropriation for me to get a better understanding? When the Deputy Minister was responding on appropriation, he indicated that that was an unconstitutional document. Am I right, Deputy Minister?
2008 bill, draft bill. In my view, and I think that was the reason why it was withdrawn, was that it contained a seriously open constitutional challenge. We think that we have, this time round, we're not in a position.
So my question is, Deputy Minister, can we take inputs that were made on unconstitutional document to the present one that is constitutional? I want to be clarified that remarks that were made based on unconstitutional documents, can they be brought forward?
No, exactly. I mean, it's an area that we've paid a great deal of attention to. But in essence, without getting into too much technical detail, the 2008 draft sought to preempt the possibility of going to court on a compensation matter, and sought to provide the state, the executive, with the right to finally determine compensation and to block access. Now, you can't block access to the court. It would be unconstitutional. And the property clause is explicit in this matter when it comes to expropriation. That if at the end of a process of negotiation and engagement between the two parties, the party to be expropriated and the expropriator, there's not satisfaction in terms of the compensation offered by the expropriator, by the state, then the expropriated, the person or entity being expropriated, has the right to go to court. But two important things need to be borne in mind. One, that a challenge in the courts around compensation does not halt expropriation. Expropriation continues. Okay, while the matter is in the court around the amount for which the entity should be compensated. What we've allowed for in the bill, because we understand that you can't expropriate or shouldn't be able to expropriate, deprive the person of a farm, let's say, and leave them with nothing while the courts and the courts often do take 2 years, 3 years or whatever to settle a matter. So in the current draft that we've got, we've said that at least 80% of what you're offering as a state must be paid to the individual at the time that you expropriate. Then if there's a need for a court case to continue and challenges around the amount, let them go ahead. We've also now introduced, which was new, I don't know if this is going into too much detail, but which was not in the draft that we presented to you, in order to prevent whimsical challenges around compensation, we've said that if what was offered finally to you, you're being expropriated as chairperson, and I'm the expropriator, and if what is being offered was offered to you finally by me as the state, if what the court decides finally is the same or less, then you carry the risk of the legal fees, the court fees, and so forth. Contrary-wise, the state would carry the burden if the award made by the court is much more. The second point I want to make is that the courts themselves are also bound, of course, by the Constitution. So it goes to the court, a compensation challenge, if it does, and we don't have to invest that this will mainly be the case, but it could be the case. The courts are bound constitution not just to look at the market value of the property, but all the other criteria that are contained in the Constitution. How was the property originally acquired? Has there been state subsidies into the property, et cetera, and you know, all those things, including market value. So that's how we've borne in mind the objection very much. That was a major focus of what we were doing this time around. And that's why we're confident. And I just think, just to say, the meta focus has gone very well, but slow. That was the main contribution to the slowness of us. We thought we could be back in Parliament by November. That's why we set that date. The can be a very slow process because it's different parties and schedules and stuff. So we really baffled and we, but it went well. So the disagreements that are signaled in the report are small and technical, and really they are business and labour hoisting, labour having something to say and then business countering, basically. So they're not shipwreck issues, but they will bring them when it comes to Parliament, as long as it is. But basically, we're getting strong support for the general direction of what we're producing, which is very different from 2008. So it's the reverse position. In 2008, something that was produced has been hurriedly withdrawn. We wish we could bring up. We're confident that with good parliamentary process, the little things that might still need to be improved can be improved. But it's not an embarrassment, which I think 2008 was. And I think what's really, I'd like to use the opportunity to thank the colleagues who've worked really hard on this matter for getting us to where we are.
It's a follow-up question on the compensation of unregistered rights. Like, for instance, you're saying if the farmer is being compensated by the state, does it, the bill, does it take care of the farm workers? What I'm trying to say is that a lot of money can be given to the farmer, and then he says, we are the must to finish it. And are the farm workers taken care of? And sort of, because it can happen.
Obviously that's a matter for if I'm talking about the expropriation, let's say, of a farm for land reform, in the public interest for land reform processes. What happens in the expropriation bill, we're simply dealing with an expropriated owner and how to fairly deal with, fairly but effectively deal with an owner. And that owner could include an owner with unregistered rights, which is not the same thing as the farm workers, okay? How the farm workers are handled in the case of land reform is not really the business of the legislation. It would be the business of land reform. I mean, it's a good question. And hopefully those responsible for land reform would be very sensitive to those on the farm. But as I say, that's not really within the sphere. But yes, unregistered owners, as well as registered owners, are covered, which is also part of what was not the case in the existing 1975.
Thank you, Jay. If I could just augment on that last question. I think what the member is saying, let's take the example of a farm being taken for a water project, for the building of a dam. There might well be a number of workers there who have constructed homes on the farm. The farmer allowed them a portion of land and they constructed their own homes. They would, in fact, in terms of the Expropriation Act, be compensated for those structures. And quite often, in the case of the Department of Water Affairs, there could well be further assistance to re-establish that elsewhere, given that that particular land would be flooded by the dam.
Thanks, Joseph. Just to respond to the issue of AgriMark and its M&E function, that is actually embedded. What is embedded in the bill is that for each certificate that AgriMark issues, it will be required to, on a regular basis, assess the production facility of that particular innovative material or technology. It's because the certificate is based on, amongst other factors, the production system. However, I must state this out, that it would not be able to monitor the importation of substandard products. Now, the use of substandard products in the construction industry is supposed to have been policed either by the engineer or the municipality. That in terms of the National Building Regulations as well as the municipal bylaws. So if you're erecting a structure and if you're using alternative technology, you are required to produce to the inspector the agreement certification. If you're putting on roof truffle and it is required to be at a particular angle and it's required to be of a particular width, then that certificate ought to be supplied to the inspector. The problem is we have a breakdown at that level, at the point of verification of or assessing the quality. And it's largely at a municipal level that you find it. I will, by way of example, if you take Florida as an example, those, some of those inspections are very, very stringent in some of the inspections areas they work in. So I think there has been a general improvement over a period of time in terms of the assessments that are going to. And it's largely linked to the NHBRC, because when there's a problem with the structure, the NHBRC gets involved, and then they start pointing the fingers at who should have done what along the country. Tend to find there's a greater emphasis now for compliance. But what remains the problem is, if that is not followed through consistently, you will have the problem of substandard products entering the market space and reducing consumption. And I think one of the things that we identified largely in our research when we were doing AgriMa was that you find it happens largely in the rural areas and deep rural areas because you don't have the inspectors out there. And then you find the use of substandard bricks in those areas. So I think part of the problem is that you fix AgriMa, we need to fix the compliance part and ensuring compliance is adhered to. The question on IDC, and that is currently doing a lot of work for the Department of Education, is currently funded through the Department of Education due to the current funding model of IDC where it charges a management fee. But in terms of the business case that's been advanced now and that's been put forward, we've advanced that it becomes a Schedule 3A public entity, which means it will be funded directly to the fiscal. Currently, it's a Schedule 2 public entity and it needs to do its own revenue and go out and competitive bidding, etc. So therefore, its current funding model changes significantly to the one that we are proposing now, that it will be funded directly to the process. I think that addresses the concern about the sustainability issue. Chairperson, the last question is yours on engineers. And you are correct. You have very examples. Some people, is when you register as a candidate with a professional council, and if you use engineer by way of example, if you don't get the required scope of work, the training relevant scope of work, then you're never able to register as a professional engineer or a professional technologist. And you are right, that the problem that you raised about people making tea, I think this was raised way back in 2007-2008 when we introduced the rules. Those problems consistently persist. Now, it is for that reason we've worked with CIDV to develop the Skills Development Agency, which is soon to be presented to DPWXCO for consideration. And it is one of the institutions that we would use now to address that very problem, where we would, through government contracts, rotate built environment professions so that a student gets the relevant scope of work and relevant scope of experience that's required for them to register. Yes. It's exactly what we've got at DDW. We have a program that does it. It takes students from university or university of technology all the way to professional registration. And that has to be a very structured and detailed program. Now, it will continue to remain a challenge in the private sector if you don't get the private sector more to ensure that students get the required training. Now, I know we've had discussions with CVE to get this process going, and we need to get the professional councils on board. What will largely change the situation is once we've developed the policy framework on professional registration. It has been developed, we just need to get it finalized and approved, which speaks to what will be the roles and responsibilities of the various institutions. And we place in that document huge emphasis on CVE and or the professional council to drive the candidacy program
And it is during the candidacy program that they get the practical thing that you're referring to. So we will begin to shift the onus of the practical part back to the professional counselors to manage. The issue of accreditation of universities, that has been a tragedy for a long time. We're hoping that it has been addressed. There was an instruction that we issued to professional councils that they must begin to make this process more transparent. That is, one of the things that we advanced to them was the need for all accredited universities and universities of technology to be listed on their website, list the accredited ones on their website, so students know which universities to go to. You often find, correctly and well, that students go to a lot of private institutions which are not accredited, and then are not able to register. We will obviously need to take the matter forward again through our engagement with CB and the professional council if this has not been addressed. I think a lot of problems that we identified were largely coming from the rural provinces, the Mpumalanga, the Limpopo, the Eastern Cape, where this largely arose. But we will certainly follow this through with the professional council. On the health and safety issue, I think I partly addressed that. This is largely driven by the engineers and the inspectors on site. If that doesn't happen, then you will continue to have these health and safety challenges. If you take, for example, what has happened in the investigation, I think, has just been completed by the Department of Labor, and the report has not yet been finalized. But it suggests that there was a number of and this is not based on any scientific research, sort of what we've been hearing, is that one, there was substandard material that was used. Two, there was insufficient time for curing. Three, the structural integrity of the structure was compromised because of certain activities by the contractor. For example, they cut off steel when they should not have cut off steel. So this gave rise to some of the problems. Hopefully we should get a detailed report from the Department of Health that indicates what were the problems in that particular example of a construction tragedy. I think the overall problem that you're raising, though, is one that we must address. And we try to address it when we're dealing with the AgriMark issue of bringing together the engineers and inspectors from municipalities to make sure what happens is actually does happen. Because you take any slight infringement or non-compliance to any of the national building regulations, then you will end up with some major, major tragedy. Thanks, Chief. I think I've just...
Can I make a follow-up? If you remember when we were in the Public Works Summit last year, Dr. Mashavani, Motsepe, the architect, raised a concern around professional counselors not, I don't know how to put it, Deputy Minister, but they raised a concern. And you were there, and we made a recommendation as a particular committee that there's a model that they must follow that will make them sort of equal in their counters, because they were saying, I'm sorry, Deputy, I need to just make it so that all of us. They were saying these counters are an aging, old, white, men's terrain, if you remember DJ. That you can't go through. There's a blockage. And we recommended that there's a model that they need to follow. And we made a recommendation of that model. Only I've forgotten there's a council, I don't know what the quantities are there, that has a very good model that they need to follow. So say to me, it's a worrisome issue for me still having blockages, Deputy Minister. So I would like to go and age peacefully, knowing that our children have access
to trains that they were blocked not to get into. They, with architects like I'm saying, the Mashabani raises concern. And I'm told left, I don't know, but left with those problems. And we made a recommendation that that municipal guy should make a presentation to the Department of Public Works. Because these are the issues that they are faced with. I don't know if the DG, I raised this issue with you to say how far are you with this issue. Is it getting attention for our children to be able to go through?
I think in the with the process that was organized by the minister, we and I think in various discussions also at Minta of the NEXCO, we looked at this particular problem. I think the model you are talking about, we, if I'm correct, is the chartered accountants model, which is a structured program, defined time frame, and an ability for external evaluation and examination process. That is what they have been dealing with. And I think they are coming up with that. When he talks about getting an engineer and make sure that there are requirements, not voluntary arrangements, that are open-ended for a trainee to go through the processes and get transferred to others, etc., etc. They are looking at it. When they have had to structure it such that it fits the kind of profession they're dealing with. I think what one learns in the engineering environment, for example, is that it's not quite like the accounting environment, but there are similarities. The engineering profession is so widespread that it is not possible to finish it. But you need to streamline. If you may get an engineer who is a civil engineer, even a civil engineer, and I learned that it actually is in different categories. You need to define exactly what you have a complete professional would be able to deal with that particular industry. And that's, so, in short, we are dealing with that issue, and we are actually proposing that we take into account that approach. And that is what he's saying is they are going to be bringing to us at EXCO. There have been various discussions, engagements with various professional bodies in order to develop a proper process. I'm sure when we come back here with the CDE, we will have probably caused a lot of the different areas that relate to this. So, yes, Chair, thank you very much for your leadership.
This morning, the morning like this to me, there was this guy, the CEO of whether it's Gita or what, Gita, G-I-H-A, who was saying they have built accommodation for students, because there's a shortage of accommodation for students. And here I'm talking about safety, health and safety issues. Underneath, the other day they have used waste material, sort of waste material. There are four buildings, sort of, whether they are seen or what, 1, 2, 3, 4. On top, there's another building that they have made. What is that? So that, do we really have on those issues? And inside, they sort of have used waste material. It's nice inside. But when it comes to health and safety standards, what I would say, though I saw the discussion, the presentation right in the middle, but are we taking care of all those buildings that I think are coming up to say, are they up to standard? Because with IDT and this conventional method of building schools, we agreed what we were explained to. But what about those buildings that we saw this morning, displayed, say, they can be utilized by schools? There's a shortage of accommodation. Should anyone that come up with a structure to say, because there's a shortage of structure? And they asked this guy to say, what do you think about Cape Town? And not Cape Town, also in the process of doing that, but they're going to take this old container and make accommodation to them. What do you say about it? I'm sorry to bring in an issue that has not, but when it comes to health and standards, I think we need to bring them in.
Just a follow-up comment about the transformation in the built environment. There is a need. For instance, there are I have forgotten the name, but they are 99 point whatever percentage quite only. We need that the transformation like yesterday. It's really not accepted.
Thank you. I'm familiar with that example. I would imagine they probably use waste material. I think if it occurs and it's substandard and it doesn't have the certification appropriate from any of the standards, it might be a failure of the municipality. We might just need to take it up and check if it has gone through the materials that exist, has gone through any of the standards or setting or institutions. And if not, then there will be a problem. Definitely. I think the issue of the transformation, I think, is what we're grappling with.
Can we move to the charter? Let's keep reflecting. I understand, Honorable Mwenye Mabila, that there are so many issues, but we need to deal with this. The most important one was about the legislation to me. That was the most important thing for me. Can I fight here? Keep raising.
Thank you, Chairperson. What we've done is we've broken up the presentation into one is a property charter, one is a construction charter. We started the construction charter, but in terms of my highlight perspective,
this financial year will be largely driven by the two same initiatives or projects by both charters. So this slide that you're looking at now is what we as the construction charter council presented to you previously. Largely speaks to the registration and establishment of the Charter Council. I think this is one of the first major highlights that we need to speak through. And I'm aware that the Property Sector Charter Council is also addressing undertaking the same initiative. It's called the Baseline Project. What has happened is on the construction side, the charter was generated in 2009. And we are now in 2013, which is the second phase of the Charter Council. Now, the problem was, in 2009 and 2011/12, the council was not functioning optimally. We didn't have an upper, didn't have a CEO. We were still negotiating the constitution, etc. But since the appointment of the CEO in early 2013 and the establishment of the office, the work that has been done in the last year has been tremendous. The Charter Council has now establish itself within the industry. It is known to be one of the major stakeholders. It is invited to all major events in construction industry and has rightfully been displayed as in the construction industry. And what is most important is recognized as one of the key drivers to transformation. What we initiated last year was what we consider the baseline study. We want to know to what extent has the construction industry transformed. And in this regard, We have established a database, we've begun collecting data, and that largely follows the route of collecting BE certificates. And then we capture the rating within of the certificates for each company, and that will give us a picture of the level of transformation within the construction industry amongst the various the categories. For example, ownership, women empowerment, youth empowerment, procurement and corporate social investment, etc. We are currently sitting at 3,500 certificates. In the first 6 months of the project, I think we had less than 1,000. But in the last 2 months, we were able to get in the region of 2,000 certificates alone. So the CEO has put a huge effort in this. Now, this business study looks for the first period from 2009 to 2009 to 2012, and then from 2012 to 2015. So the first leg of the study is currently what we're engaging with, looking at those certificates. And while you're collecting the certificates, you're also collecting the certificates for the second phase, because from each company, we are requesting all of the certificates that they have.
we should, within the next 2 months, have a very clear picture of transformation for the first phase. And hopefully by the end of this, the next financial year, we will be able to submit a comprehensive report for the entire period from 2009 to 2014 to DTI. And then we are required to report annually to DTI. And the Constitution requires that the report be submitted to the Minister of Public Works for engagement before submitting to DTI, simply because the Minister is responsible for the regulation of the construction industry. So this is one of the first pictures you're going to get of transformation of the construction industry, which you should get within the next few months as the major project. The second one, Chairperson, is I'm going to skip this because it largely speaks to some of the practice law that are developed by the Construction Charter Council to guide the implementation and guide compliance to the code. The next one is this year. As you're aware that DTI recently gazetted the new BEE code, which has reduced the elements from 7 elements to 5 and has brought in certain elements within other elements. So for example, you can't just simply talk about empowerment or employment equity without specifically speaking to the empowerment of youth and women. Now, for the next up until October of 2014, both the construction and property sector charter council will be focusing on realigning its current code with the revised code. Now, this is a huge task because it largely brings back to opening up negotiations that started that was concluded in 2009. Because here now you will be setting new targets for the industry, you will be setting new processes for things to happen in terms of how you will achieve targets. You would need to go out and re-educate the implementers of these the codes, particularly within the major stakeholders, and that's the BBCBE, the SAP, SECs, etc. To give effect to this, there will be 5 task teams that will be established, each aligned to each code, and there will be special advisors that will be assigned to the established industry as well as the emerging sector. So there's quite a vigorous, complex, tedious exercise ahead for this alignment process. The big argument that has been advanced was there were certain sectors that said you shouldn't be resetting new targets, you should just continue with the existing targets. But then the argument that has been advanced by other quarters is that if we do not revise the targets, we won't be significantly achieving the transformation as envisaged. So I think that the property charter has also agreed to play a very similar route as the construction sector charter to establish work streams for each area, for each of the codes, and then renegotiate targets for those. Obviously, the renegotiate means that we would have to achieve targets higher than what has been gazetted by DTI. Unfortunately, we can't give you any further details on this because the work has not really started. It's the preparatory work has been done by the Charter Council. They've been putting up tenders for specialists in this area. The actual negotiations should start around the end of March on these revised codes. So that's my for the construction sector Charter Council, those are the big two focus areas for this financial year. I assume the same would apply for on the property side. This next slide speaks to what would be happening in terms of the processes that will be followed to achieve the October deadline. And this October deadline is really not negotiable because you guys insisted that all councils must meet this deadline. So you're looking at the analysis of the BEE codes and consultation, which has already taken place, the drafting of the aligned sector codes. That is once the specialists have been appointed, the project will begin. Now then you'll have your draft set of codes, then you'll go into consultations with your broader industry, and then in August you will publish for public comment, and then you need to finalize and submit to DTI around September, October. That's the process that will be followed on in this regard. The other issues that we wanted to raise was that we've had roadshows, particularly for the public sector, to highlight that the need to comply with construction sector charter codes. That's taken place. And the thing is, we would need to redo this again once we've got revised code replaced. The others are just operational issues that are being addressed by the construction site council. The same applies to the UD property sector. And is anything specific to you? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. This also falls on the back of quite a... Is it okay now, Chair? Again, this follows on the back of previous presentations that have been made by the Property Charter Council. We're not going to go into the history of how the Charter Council came about. It's well known. Just a brief breakdown of the property sector, consisting of commercial, residential properties, as well as zoned land that is therefore zoned for commercial residential development, mostly in urban areas. These are the organizations and associations that are members of MINLAC, of the Property Charter Council. Again, we have detailed information on each one of them should that be required by the committee. Just a brief recap of research that the Charter Council has done. First project was to establish the size of the property market. The information reflected on the slide is from the 2010-2011 financial year. Important to state that the values reflected here are based on the value of structures, buildings only, from which the participants in this sector generate their income. And it must be made clear that these figures were taken from existing sources. So unfortunately, as far as the figures presented for the public sector, quite clear that the bulk of those would be based on municipal valuations. As we know for public works, we have to admit that we don't have updated market valuations on our properties. That is an ongoing project. So these are very much ballpark figures and should not be seen as absolutes. The second project of research done by the council was really the contribution that the property sector brings to the SA economy. And this is really based on the funds or the income generated by the players in the property field. Again, important to note that one of the projects of the Property Charter Council is to standardize terminology. Now, they themselves use terminology end of cycle. You will see on the left-hand side. That end of cycle refers to disposals, alienation, sales, or leases, or where property is redeveloped. The funds, the income that is generated through those projects. The third and current project of the Charter Council is really to analyze the actual transformation in the sector. Important to state that is nearing completion. A full report should be available in May. Right now, the scorecards are being collected and studied towards the compilation of a final report. The presentation goes on to list the individual participants in property sector that were selected for this study. You will see, for instance, the big three institutional owners of Old Mutual Fund, Lovestan Lib, and so a number of others were selected. Basically, those selected constitute 70% of the value generated in the entire sector. And as said, the report should be available in May. I'm sure there will be a lot of debate about that. What is important, the findings that are already available, points to the fact that this sector lags behind in transformation. As an indicator there, out of the 38 registered estate agents, only 13% are black. And out of the 11,000 agencies currently in operation, in operation in 2012, between 2 and 4% were blacks, with no black agencies in the leading group. Now, as far as the commercial industry is concerned, the industry notes that the implementation of the Department of Public Works' leasing strategy, or its full name, the Property Management Strategy on BE, Job Creation and Poverty Alleviation, provided some certainty in the market, particularly for those instances that make accommodation available on a lease basis to the state. We also saw that a number of the life insurance companies decided to sell off their assets to smaller entities, and this has at least created some opportunities for black stakeholders. There is, however, a major threat, and that is that in the marketplace, if a black-owned company should build up an attractive portfolio, obviously, as any other smaller company, it becomes prey to larger companies for buyouts, often hostile takeovers. So what the Chartered Council is saying is that the drive to create opportunities for black participants in the market might well lead to them being successful and then disappearing as black-owned companies from the market as they are bought out by others. But one must assume that that is the normal function of the market. Nevertheless, the BE scorecards that are currently being investigated will indicate more clearly the role that black participants are playing. Problems experienced by black participants are quite substantial. The issue of banks requiring a very high level of equity before granting loans. The National Endowment Fund has in fact halted its funding. Industrial Development Corporation in its policy does not fund property transactions. And there is scant evidence of development by other development finance institutions. So funding remains a major stumbling block for a new entrance into the property market. Chair, in short, just to whet your appetite for the presentation of the April-May final report, where the Property Charter Council is gearing up to make a full presentation to you.
Thank you, Mr. Merring, Mr. Pillay. Honourable members, those are the highlights. For me not to be labelled as a slave drive, can we pass this one, and if there are questions, can we move to next week when we will be presenting on asset register, if I'm not mistaken. Do we agree? I think we need to close this meeting. But next week, I want to make a request to Deputy Minister. To say next week when presented on asset register, if honourable members will remember when we were in the Eastern Cape, the presenter there spoke about quadrant rent. And he said quadrant land is where rivers run. To say they've got a separate register of quadrant, something like that, I don't know. You know, I'm just, you must understand me. Yeah, to say, can we get an explanation of whether rivers are part of the asset register? Who is in charge of rivers, Mr. Mary? Because if government is not in charge of rivers, am I allowed just to go and divert water from the river to my dam? Because it happens where people just divert water from the river to their dams, to their farms. So if all of us can do that, will we not be blocking people from accessing water? Because it happens. Can some of those things be covered for us to understand what is it? Because some of us in the rural area are sitting with this problem of sort of quadrant. They don't understand what quadrant land is all about, but I just want to understand some of these things. Deputy Minister, I think we need to know this meeting. Anything from your side?
No, thank you.
Didi?
But we'll Google that Wikipedia. Try please. Response.
On that note, I like to think. That's what I want to say. On that note, I want to thank honorable members for their participation, for their attendance. You know, this is one of the best committee when it comes to attendance. Deputy Minister, really, and also participation and performance. Thank you very much, all members, DG and Interest. Thank you very much. And Khanisi Dach.